I'm gonna destroy you. Everything that you find, even holy.
Why?
Oh, I don't know.
Episode of Jabber and the Drone, the movie review podcast that politely disagrees to agree. You are Richard Wally from Portland, Oregon.
And you are Cassidy Robinson from Garden Grove, California.
This week we have Richard Bott. Since
you're Richard Bott.
Since Richard was too busy to make it, he has now sent his homemade android to replace him.
I wish that was true.
It's very lifelike.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I wish I could make clones, too, and then I wouldn't have to do a lot.
Yeah, like Multiplicity.
Yeah, like exactly like it. I hope they downgrade and, like, I mean, they'd be really stupid really quick, but I wish they'd downgrade in IQ as well, like those ones.
Mm-hmm. Would you make a really sensitive Richard to be the husband and caretaker?
No, I'm the really sensitive Richard that's the caretaker.
Oh, okay. So then what would the other Richards be doing? You'd have one do the podcast. I know that for sure.
Yeah, one would do the podcast.
And maybe even one go
see the movie.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question, though? Are
sure.
we really the podcast that agrees to disagree? Because it seems like we've been agreeing the last few weeks.
We're not
living up to that moniker.
The year is young.
The year is young. We need to disagree today. That's what I'm saying. So anything you say, I'm just going to be antagonistical today.
Yeah. Well, no, luckily, this summer has been pretty good. I think also we're getting better at avoiding the movies we know we're not going to like.
Well, we can.
Yeah.
No longer in Idaho. Before you're like, I have to go see this. And I'm like, I really don't want to, though.
Yeah. I have to go see this Katherine Heigl comedy, and that's all that's coming out. Yeah, now I'm in California, I can see better movies that I'm sure you're more interested in. So yeah, it has been a little bit more easygoing here, but we'll see what happens.
Is today the day?
I don't know.
That we'll throw off the gloves?
We'll see what happens. If you want to make news...
If I want to make news?
Yeah.
One podcast host threatened to kill another podcast host, and then NSA stormed his house.
Today we're going to be talking about The Purge Anarchy and Dear Mr. Watterson in our Netflix homework.
That'll be the one.
That's the one. Fuck Bill Watterson and his stupid tiger.
Whoa! What the fuck? You take that back. Okay.
No. All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into the news. I think we've wasted enough time trying to get our bearings. And I'll let you start. What's our first news story?
What is my first news story? You said I can't read it in order. So, Dwayne Johnson sort of admits he's playing Shazam. Now, if you watch the video, he doesn't kind of admit. He admits that he's playing Shazam. That works. That definitely at least gives, I mean, as a character, he is on par, like, strength-wise and stuff
with
Superman. So that could be actually fairly interesting.
Yeah. Now, they just released a little bit ago, DC released their schedule,
mm-hmm.
and Shazam was one of these characters. So this is how we know, we're able to kind of deduce that he's talking about Shazam.
Right.
I mean, other than the fact that he's, like, you know, short of saying, it rhymes with Shmamam.
He pretty much tells you
he denies his... that he's playing Jon Stewart, which some people originally thought.
Right. Well, I mean, his literal words was, oh, he's on par with strength-wise as Superman. And I don't know if there's any other characters that are.
Yeah.
That are heroes as well. And then, well, I guess you can flip. Well, Green Lantern, no, he said strength, buddy. Shut the fuck up. And then, but then he goes, you just say the word, and it's like, come on. Come on. Yeah. Come on, Dwayne Johnson.
But I wonder if his publicist was like, you just told everybody. He's like, no, I didn't. He's like, you just told everybody.
Yeah, DC was pissed. They just like threw down everything. Fuck.
That was our big Comic-Con reveal, and you just fucked it up.
Yeah.
Nobody's going to come to Hall H.
Actually, I always wanted him to play a character that's called Black Adam. That was Shazam.
Mm-hmm.
So this is getting super nerdy. But he was Shazam, but basically he was Shazam at the time during, like, when Egypt was big. But then he got the moniker taken away because he was too violent and too mean. But he survived throughout all these years. Yeah. I wanted him to play that character because he's really cool. But, you know.
Yeah. What about Steel? John Henry Iron?
No, I wanted that to be played by Shaq. I wanted him to retake up the reins for that film, but that's just me.
Really? Yeah, because, you know, it was kind of marred by being under budget, and that movie could have worked.
I think it did work.
It worked at something.
I don't even... Just admit it. I mean, we were both childs of the 90s, so we watched a bunch of crappy movies.
A bunch
had
of...
bad special effects.
Shitty superhero movies when there wasn't 9 a year.
Yeah, yeah, when there weren't 9 a year,
you were
starving, so you'd watch still, and you'd be like, oh boy, Meteor Man, here it comes, oh yeah.
I'm so glad you went straight to Meteor Man.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking about.
I do. All right, my first story. Mark Ruffalo could be Columbo on the big screen. For anyone under, 30 years old, Columbo was a detective show from the 70s and 80s. Fairly popular. Starred Peter Falk. And there is a dude, a producer, who basically announced on Twitter, the producer's name is Gary Whitta. And he said he wanted to bring this to the big screen, and his first choice would be Mark Ruffalo. And they show a picture here of Peter Falk looking a little Ruffalo-esque.
Well, they kind of look like each other.
A little bit. I mean, I
get it. I think the article is a little, you know, putting the cart before the horse.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that's like saying, well, we'd really like to have... yeah, it could be any star. We'd really like to have Robert Downey Jr. as what's his face's role from Twin Peaks. Like, that's cool. Cool story, bro, but
well, I don't know. I mean, a Columbo big screen movie, it has some brand recognition. I don't know how well that brand really translates to anybody who's pays to see movies.
Well, they're gonna make it dark and gritty, and they're gonna make it David Fincher, they're gonna bring him on to do it, so it'll be pretty decent.
It'd be an unofficial sequel to Gone Girl.
I'm just saying that's that guy's first pick as director, so
yeah. All right, what's your other story?
My other story is Edgar. It was just announced fresh off the press this morning, I believe, that Edgar Wright's next movie, since he recently pulled away from the Ant-Man film, is going to be called Baby Driver. Now, this was a film that he's actually had on the books for a while.
Yeah.
He was going to do it after Hot Fuzz. Mm-hmm. But that film actually ended up being The World's End.
Yeah.
It's supposedly kind of a spoof on action and crime kind of stuff. I hope it's more crime spoofy, you know, maybe go a little noirish as opposed to, because he kind of did that with Hot Fuzz already. So if he's going to make, you know, if he's going to do the Rebound movie, he needs to at least make something that he hasn't yet. So
yeah. Yeah. About the titles, though, when I hear Baby Driver, all I can think of is, like, shitty early 90s kid vid, like Baby's Day Out.
That's kind of what I think of, but I think of, like, a taxi.
Yeah.
Like, but about then a baby, just a baby and just, who like... Who
drives a taxi around the city.
It could be, you know, it could also be, like, a horror movie. Like, Baby Driver. Like, running yeah, over like a, you this summer. Boo Boo Gaga.
I thought you meant, like a black exploitation movie or something where they just call women baby.
No. No, I mean, like, a baby is in a car, and you see him on the wheel, and as the wheel turns, you just kind of see his little head go back and forth, and just running people down.
Because that's he doesn't know how to drive, because he's a baby.
Yeah, so exactly. So that's frightening, right?
It's kind of like Speed. They have to, like, somehow, like, find this baby and get him out from behind the wheel.
But it's impossible.
Yeah.
Because it's really a baby... Oh, yeah. We've yeah. gone too... I've gone too far.
Green light it.
Yeah. You know, it's not the worst idea, you know, rubber. Just saying.
Fair enough.
Call me Hollywood when you make my movie. I would like money.
Mark Romanek checks into the Overlook Hotel for a prequel to The Shining. Now, we've already talked about how there could be a possible prequel. There, it's in the works.
It's already done.
And Mark Romanek, the director of One Hour Photo and Never Let You Go,
Let Me Go, I thought it was.
You're right. Never Let Me Go.
Never Let You Go, that's very specific. That would be, like, very hard to make a film based around that. I'm sorry. I'll stop sometime today.
Good.
This is what happens when you wake me up to podcast.
He's set to direct the movie, and he's one of my favorite directors who infrequently works.
Mm-hmm.
1 Hour Photo, I think, is kind of a masterpiece. And, you know, one of Robin Williams' like most exciting and daring roles he's ever played, and just a visually creepy movie. Never Let Me Go actually was like kind of heartbreaking, and
Love that film, man.
Yeah, I thought it really worked. A lot of people weren't that into it, but I thought it was a really cool movie.
Oh, agreed.
Really, really kind of subtle science fiction. And he, you know, he's a great visual filmmaker, and he was a music video guy before. He worked with Nine Inch Nails, most famously the Closer video, which visually is really bizarre.
One is that? No, the only thing I can think of Nine Inch Nails is the Fuck Me Like an Animal
one. That'd be the one, yeah.
Oh, that's Closer? Oh, yeah. Okay.
When, you know, the hanging meat and him with, like, the
licking the microphone.
And, yeah, and all that stuff. Yeah, that was Mark Romanek.
Oh, okay. Of the two films that he's made, I've liked it. He was also trying to make a Lock and Key TV show, so that's cool, but...
Mm-hmm.
So is he... Can I ask...
He's all about the horror now.
Yeah, I mean, has he tried to be making, like, movies, and it's just always, like, kind of, like, gone under, or do you know much?
I don't know. I like him a lot, but I guess I haven't followed his career that extensively to see, like, what he's been doing, what... I mean, you know how Hollywood works. You have to have 17 plates spinning to get one thing made.
It's true.
And for people who don't have a large body of work and who have, you know, two films that are critically well-received but generally haven't been seen all that much, it's even harder to get your stuff made. So it makes sense that he's going to do something with a big brand like The Shining... and I would, you know, I normally would say that I don't need a Shining prequel. I really don't. But if Mark Romanek's doing it, that makes me a smidgen more interested.
Okay. I mean, I guess I can kind of like be like, okay, with the movies he's made, I can kind of.
He has a Kubrickian sense. Like he likes things kind of cold and distant and a little clinical in that sort of same way.
Well, yeah, and he's just... that's what I was going to say. He seemed kind of Kubrickian in the two films that I've seen of his.
Yeah.
The two films that he's made. So, yeah. I mean, I get it. I don't know. It's sort of interesting because they do have a sequel to the book, but they're doing the prequel to The Shining, so that's...
Yeah, I would think they'd do Dr. Sleep, but...
Well, I mean, they did. I mean, the first movie, which they're trying to kind of go off of anyways, it's a pretty big departure from the book as well. So,
yeah.
I don't know. It makes sense. I guess it's good that they're trying to go on if they're going to use a brand, they're venturing into unknown ground or territory. So
yeah,
I guess that's good about it too. I just don't. I mean, do we also know who the writers are? Those kind of things about the film.
That I don't know. But okay. My only issue with this, well, I have some amount of issue with this, but I think one of the great things about Kubrick's film version of The Shining is the ambiguity. Mm-hmm. You know, they made a whole documentary because the movie's so ambiguous that anyone can read whatever they want into it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something kind of cool about that movie, is that it invites interpretation and invites you to really kind of study it. Now, if you make a prequel that says, oh, well, the reason that Jack Nicholson is in the photo at the end is because blah, 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 that'll be kind of deflating.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's that whole debate whether with making sequels to movies or rebooting or stuff, if it really, like, I don't really think it does take away from the original.
No.
Because I can just be like, well, that was shit, and throw it away. And honestly, I do think it does bring people back to watching the original, or at least bring some attention to the original. So,
yeah,
we'll see. I mean, again, I could see the talent behind it and the idea behind it. I wish he had a larger body, but for whatever reason. But I also understand that his films have been very severely overlooked. So, and honestly, like another music video guy who released Under the Skin this year.
Yeah.
That was a great film, and he hasn't been seen or heard of for a long time.
Yeah, he makes movies pretty infrequently, too. He's made, I think, two other movies besides Under the Skin.
So,
But yeah, no, that's a... we'll see.
It's a tentative we'll see.
Okay. Yeah. And we'll see if it even goes through, first of all. Because, you know, these kind of projects, these big-name projects like this, tend to, you know, stay in production hell for years before they actually make it to the screen. Well, let's go ahead and get into the pet topic, which this week is your turn.
You're like, oh, crap, what's going to happen here?
Here we go. What's going to happen?
Okay, if an elephant may... No, nothing like that. No, I was kind of... So these fake criterions have been starting to be posted, but sometimes they'll get posted and I'll get really excited. And then I'll realize that it's not real, like, maybe, like, 5 minutes later, and be like, oh. Like,
yeah. And if it's not by Criterion's own website, you can probably guess it's not real.
Yeah. Specifically, the one that I saw that I was kind of excited about was Tremors.
Yeah.
I would like to see a Criterion. I mean, I halfway joked with you before we started recording, but I do kind of mean this. I wish Criterion would do an edition for every film. And I do mean that. I mean, like, every film. It could be the worst piece of garbage.
Yeah,
like,
The Ugly Truth, The Criterion.
Yeah, I want to know how that went wrong and why that went wrong. I mean, sometimes you know, but I wanted, like, we need an...
You want, like, analysis. A Heart of Darkness comprehensive documentary on every production.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There's a great Tumblr... they actually discontinued it just recently, but there was a great Tumblr blog called fakecriterions.tumblr.com where you can see a bunch of these. They have one here for Jaws 3D, Indiana Jones, Charlie's Angels, etc. Yeah,
we'll post that up for the kids at home.
Yeah.
But no, I was wondering, are there any films that you kind of do actually want a Criterion edition for?
But you know won't.
But you know, yeah, for obviously won't.
For this, that, or the other reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Cool. Cool story. We're done.
Good show, guys.
Do-do-do-do-do.
I'm trying to think, actually.
Curtain closers.
I had something and then I kind of lost it in the interim. Do you?
I have a few, yeah. I mean, I think Alien would be kind of cool to have a Criterion. I mean, they have a large body of stuff for that, actually. I would also say, normally I would say something like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but I actually think that that's pretty close to Criterion.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think whoever... the Alien Blu-ray that exists right now is you know, Criterion could probably not do all that much better. It looks beautiful. It comes with more special features than you'll have time to watch.
Yeah, that's true.
That's the thing is, like, you know, we kind of hold up Criterion to these certain kind of standards because, you know, their whole approach is the whole film school in a box.
Mm-hmm.
So you have all the essays and you have all these people really contextualizing the film. But then, you know, there's usually a lot of extras and special features, and then they might port over commentaries that are only from European releases and that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But one actually just came to my mind that I think I'd like to see on Criterion. Danny Boyle's 28 Days Later.
No, that would be... No. That's a good one.
I think it is both socially important and...
It started the new zombie... I mean, in film anyways, it started the new zombie craze.
It did. But it's also kind of a technical achievement in low-budget filmmaking, and I think it is actually artfully done.
While we're talking about that, I'd like to see Sunshine, just putting it out there.
Yeah, that would be nice too.
I mean, anything Danny Boyle.
And there's a few that are on the Criterion from him. Well, Shallow Grave. Yeah, which is... That kind of blew my mind, because that was one of those ones I always thought, like, oh, wouldn't that be cool? And then they did it.
Well, specifically with Criterion, I mean, what they're not going to get is something like Alien, because, Fox isn't going to give up their baby to another company.
Exactly. Well, for a lot of these, the issue isn't necessarily Criterion has their nose in the air. Yeah. It's more so that it's hard to get the rights to these, you know, these big properties that... So when you're thinking about your dream Criterions, you kind of want a dream medium. You want to dream like something that they could literally get.
Yeah.
Actually, one that I've wanted to see for years on the Criterion Collection, I think a lot of people would like to see it because of its scarcity, is Ken Russell's The Devils.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything kind of more recent? Maybe something that hasn't come out yet, or on DVD, or...
Well, you know, I mean, everybody's... The one that's kind of just coming to mind, but it's just obvious, and it's probably going to happen, is Pan's Labyrinth, but...
Yeah.
I was thinking E2 Moment Ambien, but that just happened as well.
Yeah, that's coming out later, I think, in August or September.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hell, why don't we just throw in Children of Men?
Yeah, that would be a really cool Criterion.
I don't know.
Back in the day, Criterion was... We tend to think of them now as being this kind of academic thing, and that they only look at quote-unquote art film. But there was a point in time when Criterion was just the main company and distributor for Laserdisc. When Laserdisc was a thing, and they were more into the preservation of aspect ratio than they were the quality of the film. So that's why the first few Criterions, there's stuff on there like The Rock and Armageddon and RoboCop and, you know, these movies that we wouldn't consider art films by today's standards. So
for real, yeah.
So, I mean, there are some things out there I think that they wouldn't... It wouldn't be so far out of reach for them to do a genre film.
No, and I don't think it is. I don't think it is for them either. I think they've kind of got a certain rap for being that way. But I mean, they also get things like, you know, The Blob, for example.
Mm-hmm.
There seem to be a couple others that were like that. And yes, those are older films and they're well respected. Blah blah blah. But
Carnival of Souls, yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I have a few B movies.
So, I mean, I think that they do want to dip their toes in. I think that just sometimes they have a hard time getting them, especially some of the ones that people would be more, that kind of have a better reputation.
I would like to see, and I mean this seriously, I'd like to see a Criterion for both Pink Flamingos and Female Trouble.
I don't know what those are. Is that those exploitation films?
The John Waters films?
Oh, okay.
Pink Flamingos?
Yeah, no, I'm not... Nope.
Oh, you need to do that one day in your life.
Okay.
That is a...
I will.
That is
that.
A crazy fucking movie.
And
Female Trouble. Both, you know, I would say those are the two films that kind of kicked off John Waters' career in a big way. And they're kind of seen as not only just these great exploitation films and midnight drive-in movies, but I think have kind of a cultural significance now, both in like the LGBT worlds, but also in kind of being pre-punk in style.
Hmm.
They're totally bizarre and unique, and they really only have shitty DVD releases of it that are overpriced because I think they're kind of sort of out of print now.
Well, yeah, that tends to happen. I guess I'd also like to see a Dead Alive.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
I think that would be a fun one. You said more recent, so there is a film that just came out a couple weeks ago that I would like to see. I would like to see Snowpiercer as a Criterion.
Oh, that'd be lovely, yeah.
Because you could go into the whole controversy surrounding why the film wasn't
more widely released. Yeah.
And you know what? After hearing it, because I wasn't really aware of why, but after kind of hearing kind of some of the issues, it kind of makes sense, actually. No, that film's great. And I think that to see a little bit more of its process and,
mm-hmm.
It was very, very similar to Brazil. So, you know, put that right next to my Brazil criterion.
Yeah. I would like to see the movie Funny Ha Ha, released by Andrew Bujalski in 2002. It's often kind of cited as being one of the first in the mumblecore movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a kind of underlooked movie because it predates the other films in the movement by about 3 years. And as far as I know, there's a pretty low-rent DVD of it, and that's it, with not very many special features. And I think, considering it is, like, basically the Breathless of mumblecore, it should probably have a little bit more of a academic look at it.
Hmm. Moon could be interesting.
Yeah.
That's a
pretty nice Blu-ray as far as the picture goes, but
yeah, as far as the picture goes, but there, I mean, so there is the aspect of them cleaning up film. So I mean, personally, anything that's 2000 or older, I think that they should clean up. But
yeah, that shouldn't even be like a Criterion specific thing. That's just like, if you're gonna do a Blu-ray release of a movie, do it. Like, don't just take a DVD quality and then like run it through a machine and give us a shitty transfer.
I'm saying is they should specifically clean it, because I've even seen people clean things but kind of over clean them or
they take away the definition or they put too much shadow and
they fuck with the colors and the colors don't come across right. Yeah.
Yeah. But actually I've kind of noticed that that's been happening less lately. And I think because everyone has HD TVs now,
mm-hmm.
they need to put better care into their DVD transfers. Right. So lately I've been, buying things that aren't Criterion. Like back when, they were doing that Universal 100 series and that kind of stuff. And
those looks pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think they're going to take time on their babies, too, a little bit more,
Yeah, the big titles, yeah. They might not care about Puppet Master 4.
That's sad.
Unless you want a Criterion of that, too.
Sure. No, I told you. I mean, I'm joking, but I'm kind of serious at the same time about Criterion doing every movie.
Mm-hmm.
I think even some of the shittiest movies, if we talk about something like, something we watched a couple weeks ago, Things, I would love to see a Criterion for
that.
Oh,
yeah.
Just so I'm like aware. I'm just like, okay, what was happening here?
Yeah. And they can't make that movie look great, but they could probably get it a little better than, that downloaded, MP4 that I had.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no, I mean, if I'm going to pay as much as they want me to pay for it right now, I would prefer it to be on Criterion.
Mm-hmm. And we should say, we're talking, while we're totally shilling for their brand. Mm-hmm. They all of their stuff is still 50% off through the month till the end of July. So you have about a week and a half to get anything from Criterion for 50% off if you go to BarnesandNoble.com or one of their locations.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah. I haven't been very rich lately, and I'm trying to save money, so I only bought a couple things.
Oh, only a couple?
Yeah, I got On the Waterfront and Breaking the Waves.
Yeah,
oh, and Scanners.
Oh, is there anything else you want to say?
No, that's it.
You want to fess up to?
That's it. For now.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
All right, is there anything else you wanted to mention, or do we want to move on to the reviews?
I could haphazardly throw out about a billion more, but we can go on to the reviews.
All right, sounds good. Yeah, let's get into it with The Purge Anarchy. And I just exited out my IMDb page, and I don't know why I did that. This actually got number two this weekend. It was a low attendance weekend, so number one is still Dawn of the Planet of the Apes at 36 million, but The Purge Anarchy came in at number two at about 30 million, so not too far under that.
Yeah, well, it also did really well on its opening night. It actually beat, on Friday night, it beat Planet of the Apes, so that's kind of...
Yeah, and it was only made for 9 million, so that's like crazy profit, but that's how these low-budget horror things kind of work.
That's how they work, and I actually, I, you know, a lot of articles that are going around now are kind of talking about the Bloom Productions, kind of they're the guys that do Paranormal Activity and Conjuring and Insidious, and they do a lot of these lower budget ones, and you can say some things about some of their products, which I mean they also did this year's Oculus, but this company specifically, you can make, you know. But, I mean, they're putting out these low-budget things for, you know, like you said, $9 million, $5 million, those kind of prices.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're having heavy, heavy returns on them. So, you know, there were film studios that were kind of built like that, like New Line that was built on top of the...
Nightmare on Elm Street series.
Yeah, exactly. So.
And originally, that's how how Lionsgate operated, until they started having big hits like Hunger Games, and now they're kind of competing on a grander scale.
Yeah, so I actually, and also in the time, how are, I mean, just kind of how films are kind of working right now, it's a really interesting model, because instead of going the 150 route, they're going a very, very small budget, and they're trying to make films that compete with those ones at an action level, at a story level, at a lot of things. So I actually think it's kind of cool. Whether I like the films or not is kind of here and there with their company, but I think that their model is very interesting.
Yeah.
But getting into the actual movie, The Purge Anarchy. So the first one was kind of a strange, I would say a strange sleeper hit for how much it was made for, and sort of strange too, because that was the period where Ethan Hawke decided he's like, I'm just going to start being in a ton of little small budget genre stuff. I'm just going to go for it.
Yeah.
Fuck it. Which good for him, like, honestly.
Yeah, he was kind of last year's Nicolas Cage.
Yeah. I mean, he was in that weird driving one that was pretty bad.
Getaway. Damn.
Yeah, I brought that up.
That was a movie.
But The Purge specifically, I did kind of like. I enjoyed the first one.
Uh-huh.
So when I saw that they were already pumping out a second one, I was like, oh, okay. Apparently, this James DeMonco, who wrote the first one and directed the first one, he also came back for the second one.
Yeah.
And he, I guess he's kind of had a little plan, and so to pump a bunch of these films out. And mm-hmm. I surprisingly, even though the first one was kind of low rent and kind of garbagey, trashy, you could say, I enjoyed it. Well, the second one is about the same kind of concept. So basically, the government, this in dystopian future kind of thing, the government on one night a year allows all citizens to break whatever the fuck laws they want, and to purge themselves through murder and violence.
Uh-huh.
And so therefore, I mean, it's silly, and I think that they totally know that it's silly that that
the premise is ludicrous.
They know that the premise is ludicrous, and I think they go for it. This film takes place on the following year, I believe, mm-hmm. and it's it actually goes to more of a street level, and it follows three different sets of people at a lower that are in a poorer kind of class range of society. Yeah. And it follows their experience and kind of ends up braiding them all together and how they have to survive the night. Mm-hmm. The film has a lot of trashy qualities like the first one. So if you're not into trashy films, this might not be up your alley. However, I'm just going to say I enjoyed it again. Uh-huh. I didn't think it was the top filmmaking, the top whatever, but it was kind of a badass Punisher movie. Like a better Punisher movie than I've seen, actually. I think Frank Grisho makes a hell of a Punisher, and he wandered around the streets blowing people away in this alternate universe. Let's see. I don't know. I just kind of enjoy the trashy quality of it, and it kind of to me is still a throwback to the kind of Snake Plissken-esque John Carpenter kind of stuff.
Oh yeah. And yeah, even more so than the last one, which we reviewed that movie and we definitely commented on. I think this guy likes Carpenter a little bit. And now it's even more apparent because this is pretty much Escape from New York meets They Live.
Yeah, and I can't say that I dislike that. I do. I like both of those films. And this kind of does a modern kind of trashy version of those. And I'm into it.
Mm-hmm.
The acting is a little on the sketchy side, but I'm okay with that. I'll just say it.
All right.
Well, I think it's kind of funny because it is trashy, but they play in a realm of like, I mean, it's funny because when I was first watching it, I was a little like, ugh, like, this isn't subversive. This is just kind of like in your face. Kind of
a little on the nose.
It's on the nose, but they know, like they have to know. If they don't know,
the poster is a American flag with the red stripes made of different guns.
Yeah, I mean, so I think they know it. I think it's very purposeful, and I kind of like it for those kind of like blatantness of it.
Mm-hmm.
Specifically, some of the race stuff that they use, actually, I think is kind of, at first I was like, ew, but then they kind of came back around on it and how they kind of twisted it.
What race stuff?
Well, specifically, there are some protagonists
mm-hmm.
that are all of a certain ethnicity.
Okay.
And they're... Well, I
don't think you have to dance around this so much. There's a lot of color in the cast.
There's a lot of color in the
cast. We're seeing a lot of Hispanic. We're seeing a lot of African American, and they're definitely playing on the culture wars that, you know, there is a definite wealth disparity between white and color.
Yeah, I don't think that's bad, and I think that they show that there's of all types in the poor class. I think I like that. But one thing that I was kind of sketchy on is specifically, there's this gang of African American kids.
Yeah.
And they're all wearing white masks, I thought was interesting, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
At first I was like, I'm not sure about this. But then as it goes on, I kind of think they bring it back around in kind of a healthy light. And so, you know what? Even though the blatantness of this film and stuff, I enjoyed it. I'm just going to say it.
All right. Yeah, we did review the first movie last year. And it sounds like you feel pretty much the same as you did last time.
I think at quality level, it's pretty much
on par.
I think it's pretty much on par. What I think's interesting is I think that they traded actors for more kind of a... For more of an action budget, but I think it still works. I don't think for a film like this you need the best actors always. But
I actually don't think the acting's that bad. I mean, there's it's a little like these guys are definitely these are the guys who didn't make it on this year's CW show and So this is what they're going to do instead, which is fine. For this type of movie, I think the acting is manageable. My issue with it is, and my issue is the same issues, a lot of the same issues I had at the last one, is he definitely knows he wants to work with ideas. Like he's really excited about the allegorical details of the plot. He wants to, you know, essentially make something like an Occupy movie or something kind of like the Hunger Games for grown-ups. And he, you know, loves Carpenter, loves a certain type of genre film from a certain era, and is definitely calling back to it a lot. I don't necessarily think he's very good at any of that. And a lot of the movie I was a little bored by.
Okay.
I think narratively, there's not enough of a clear construction here. It just kind of feels a little meandering, a little episodic. And by about the 50 minute mark, I found myself yawning and kind of checking the time.
Oh, I agree that the braiding effect of the story, it's not always braided as well as it could be. I can agree that.
I do like certain things about it. I like the fact that, you know, the first one was essentially a home invasion movie. Mm-hmm. And this one, they open it up. You know, we get to see a little bit more of this world that he kind of hints at the first one. And now he maybe has slightly bigger budget. I don't know. But it is more of a street level thing. And we see a lot more purging this time around.
Mm-hmm.
It is definitely more violent than the first movie. But I feel like the violence never has a consequence. I never really feel that invested in anything or anybody. The Punisher-esque Snake Plissken archetype, who's this guy who's kind of mysterious and he ends up, you know, picking up these stragglers who didn't make it home on time and kind of protecting them. He's pretty much our main character, but we know so little about him, and he's so, I don't know, withheld and quiet, and he's trying to do that whole kind of man with no name cool thing, but it just kind of comes off as vague. And there's nothing about the world building that I don't think we haven't seen in all the movies it's referencing done better. And so I found myself just kind of feeling like this is more of a fanboy exercise than an interesting film in its own right. And I'm fine with movies referring to other movies and it being a pastiche, but it on its own, in just narratively speaking, it doesn't really hold my interest. And I think the big difference between Demonico, from what I've seen, these two films, and John Carpenter, who he clearly admires, Carpenter knows how to deal with tone in a different way. Like, There's this whole thing in this movie, where there's this rebellion group or this revolutionary group who's trying to come against government and say the purge is wrong, and you know they're kind of like this Malcolm X-y Black Panther kind of thing, saying this is all about, you know, the rich trying to stay rich and put down the poor and all that kind of stuff, and it comes up on these TV screens very much like we saw in They Live. They show up at one point in the movie for very briefly. And at that point I was like, oh, why couldn't these guys have been in the movie the whole time? Like, these guys are fun and they're wild and they have, you know, and they really pop on the screen and they have that kind of goofy sense of humor that Carpenter always knows how to balance his horror ideas with.
I guess I kind of disagree with you. I think that they introduced that pretty early in the film, so
they introduced them on the TV, they don't get to be there as characters. Instead, what we have is this guy who doesn't talk very much and a bunch of people who are just kind of bland.
The one thing that I guess the only character that really annoyed me was the daughter. She was just too much for me.
A little too precocious for any good.
And the Frank Grisho thing, no, I got it. It was a revenge kind of thing. You got that from like shot one where he's reloading his gun in his room.
No, visually he knows what he wants to do, but where's the good one-liners?
And to be honest, I don't think that that's almost needed. I think you're being a little too hard. I politely think you're fucking wrong, Abel.
I told you. It's yeah. coming.
Yeah, I knew it was coming. It had to come eventually, right? No, I think that the film, for what it is, it's fun and it's what it's supposed to be. I think you're wanting Carpenter too much out of it.
I think the
movie is going to that, but I think the movie is what it wants to be. And I think that you're trying to apply Carpenter to it and you're not going to ever get Carpenter out of it. And so I think you should just sit back and have fun for what it is. Instead of
I don't think the movie's fun, though. That's what I'm saying, is the movie isn't fun. For me, I watched it and I was mostly bored. And kind of, you know, the stuff that's supposed to come off as just genre camp or genre schlock just kind of comes off as sort of thick-headed and ugly. And I think that's because of the tone issues. Like, if he had been able to go a little more arch with it, then I could have dealt with some of those issues more. But as it stands, it kind of sounds like he's using the idea method, the allegorical thing, to be able to basically just exploit violence in a way that I think is a little unpleasant, and not even scary. If it was an effective horror movie, and I was like, you know, gripped the seat and really nervous about these characters, then I would be fine with it being gruesome. But it's not.
It's funny because you keep bringing up horror movie, and I barely see a horror movie in the first one either. I don't think these are supposed to be as much horror movies as they're kind of advertised to be. I see them as low rent actioneers with kind of maybe like a small horror like inflection.
Mm-hmm.
But, and they go for the boo scares and they go for some of that. But no, if this is your kind of thing, as you like kind of low rent trash, I think that this is good. I really do. I think that these are kind of fun. And I think that they're exactly what they're supposed to be.
I don't think they're terrible. I don't think that's the worst thing that you could ever see. I just don't think, I think they're, they're a little lazy in their execution. I don't think that he doesn't really.
I think you want the tone of a Carpenter film, but these are not Carpenter films. I think that you're putting too much on top of it because it's obviously an inflection of those films. And more
than that, I mean, it's flat out ripping them off in a lot of places. But no, I'm fine. I already said I'm fine with a movie being a pastiche. I'm fine with a movie.
But that doesn't mean that
I'm fine with the rules that this movie sets up.
That doesn't mean you're separating it, though.
Yeah. Well, no. What I'm saying is, though, that the movie isn't doing anything effectively. It's not thrilling or scary. It's not, as an action film, it's not that entertaining. It's pretty boring because the story isn't very well constructed. And as a horror film, it's not scary.
I think it's episodic, and it's not campy either.
Again, so it's just kind of not anything.
I think it's entertaining. So that's kind of where it's coming to. That's where our impasse is coming to.
Yeah. You were entertained. I was not.
I was entertained by it. I was entertained by the first one. I would caution against people, you know, it doesn't skirt around the violence. And that's something that I kind of enjoy about it too, is that it doesn't do that.
Yeah.
I like that it just goes, you know what? This is a rated R film and we're going to make one.
Yeah.
And we don't have to hide behind the sanitation issues.
No. And in that way, because it's made for such a lower budget and there's very little at stake for the studios, it does get to do what it really get to do what it wants to do. My issue is that I just don't think this director is very talented.
Because, I mean, you didn't find this at all entertaining.
In stops and starts, I think, like I said, I really enjoyed the, like, Black Panther Party thing, but that I wish that had been played up more. There's a little sequence towards the end where there's kind of a impromptu laser tag Hunger Games, which that was kind of fun. I kind of wish that had been introduced earlier in the movie. A lot of it is just kind of people wandering around a city hiding behind corners, and they don't really play up the thriller aspect in a way that makes it especially intense.
I think that the intensity, I think that the being hunted thing is, I actually think that works. And I think you're wrong there. I think that those, the, the young couple in the car, them breaking down and stuff like that. I think that that was fairly effectively done. I think you're wrong on that point. I mean, I'll admit that I don't, again, I don't think that the actors portray their roles strong enough for them to, for you to super be like invested in them. But I think this weird sort of like, I don't mind the episodic nature of it either. I think that that's fine. I actually kind of like that it's kind of anachronistic and kind of anarchy-esque. And I don't mean that just because of the title. I mean because it just kind of like it goes, oh, this happens, and then this happens, and then kind of this happens. I'm actually okay with that because I think that that makes, because you're kind of wandering into strange territory with each thing. And to me, it's almost kind of, it just kind of goes into revealing the world little bit by little bit. And I think it does work in that, in those respects. And so, again, I would tell people, if you're looking for low rent and you're not looking for anything that needs to be like, doesn't need a Criterion edition.
That's not what I'm saying.
I think that it's, you might not be trying to say that, but I think that's what you're saying.
I'm not. I don't think this movie needs to be an art film. I'm fine with it being trashy. Actually, in some regards, I wish it was more trashy.
Okay.
I would actually...
I don't know how this film could be more trashy.
But... if it edged a little bit closer to something like Walter Hill's The Warriors or Escape from New York, and it embraced the goofiness a little bit more, I think it could be...
You just want it to be more goofy. That's what you're saying.
Well, if it's not going to be scary, it needs to be something.
I think that that's kind of a faux pas of the advertising. I don't think that I don't think that it's actually going for the horror as much as it says it's going for the horror.
There's, like I said, there's entertaining things in stops and starts. It had some interesting ideas. I just don't know so much about the follow through. But let's go ahead and get into our second review, our Netflix homework, which you actually assigned me last week, which is Dear Mr. Watterson.
Mm-hmm.
I was making fun of it a little bit ago. And
how dare you?
This is a documentary, kind of a fan documentary, about Bill Watterson, who was the illustrator of Calvin and Hobbes, the popular comic that ran from the 80s through to the early 90s. And the mysteriousness of Bill Watterson as a cult of personality who chose to never market or license the characters, even though it was a wildly popular syndicated comic for many years, and people wanted to see toys and lunchboxes and all that stuff. He refused to ever license his characters. When you see those Calvin stickers on the back of people's cars, those are actually not through Bill Watterson, and those are technically not supposed to be Calvin in order for them to get around that legally. And the writer director,
not Calvin, right?
Yeah, it's Melvin that's peeing on Ford.
Yeah.
And the documentary is done by Joel Alan Schroeder, who's a younger-ish kind of dude, kind of places himself in the documentary a lot about trying to discover this guy's story by talking to other illustrators and people who were kind of friends with him or in the know, or these archivists who are taking care of his work now. What did you think?
The material in it, like, okay, it's about Calvin and Hobbes. How can you not like Calvin and Hobbes? Like, I mean, it even kind of, I mean, that they literally almost say that in the documentary. They're like, come on, everybody likes Calvin and Hobbes.
No, yeah, literally, it's one of the only comics that everybody's kind of unanimous on.
Yeah, everybody agrees. Everybody puts their stamp on it. Now, one thing I guess, okay, one of my, like, kind of, something that I wasn't into. I actually wasn't really into kind of the first part of the movie. Mm. I thought it was boring. I didn't need... I maybe needed 5 minutes of what they were doing. When I thought it was got more interesting was when they actually started commenting on... when they started kind of... You got into the comic book archive and...
Yeah.
You and then also kind of the interpretation of it. And then when they did start getting into the whole him not diluting it through marketing and that kind of stuff, and
yeah,
you know,
his integrity.
Yeah,
yeah.
I thought that was a versus people. Oh yeah, I love Calvin. You know, there's probably a good 15-minute segment I would say of that, and it needed to be like 3 to 5 at most.
Yeah.
I mean, the first little lead in could have been that, and we didn't need to go on. I don't think we needed to go. I believe that was the director of the blonde kid in it. We didn't need to go on his journey.
No, I agree.
Yeah. However, that being said, once it kind of gets into the meat and what it actually what the film was more about, I enjoyed the film more, the documentary more, and I think it does bring up some interesting. Some very interesting ideas, because specifically I can't remember the little orange cat from the 80s, that cartoon.
Heathcliff?
No, it's not Heathcliff or Garfield.
Garfield?
It's no, it's the other one that they even interview the cartoonist in it.
Oh, I don't know then. Yeah.
They interview him, but he was really popular in the 80s, and he's disappeared since.
Yeah.
And there was, I do remember people having like shirts of his, and I remember there being toys of this cartoon that disappeared, but we still have Calvin and Hobbes. And what was kind of, you know, Calvin and Hobbes, I did come about it in the same way that, I came about it because we had library day at our school, and we go to the library, and I was like, and they're like, pick a book. And I'd be like, hell yeah, Calvin and Hobbes, Yukon Ho, the Transmogrifier. My favorite they didn't talk about in the film, though, which is the Calvin Ball, I think it's called.
Yeah.
The fake game that they play.
Yeah.
Where they just make up the rules as they go along. I love that one. but when they start getting into what is art and kind of what it's talking about and talking about the low art versus high art, I actually really enjoyed that because I think that they're... I think that what Bill Watterson kind of tackled in a lot of his stuff is the fact that comics is a medium and it's not just this throwaway trash. Especially when you see some of that Winsor McCay old art, that was not Finding Nemo. Gosh damn it. Little Nemo. There we go.
Yeah.
When you see his old like art in the full pages and stuff, it's beautiful stuff. It really is.
Yeah.
They
talk a lot about how the industry has changed and how as content is increased, but the places to put content has decreased, that, you know, the space in which these artists get to work keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller to the point that they have to fit an entire Sunday strip on, you know, like a business card.
Well, what did you think about that? Because I thought that that was really interesting how what happened to the comics industry. But it's kind of, to me, what was interesting is they did kind of bring up the fact that this is kind of this isn't just comics that it's happened in. Did you get anything out of that, or?
I mean, if you're talking about sort of like how things have changed in the internet age, and how content delivery has changed, that those, you know, there's some form of that conversation that's happening in every medium, whether it's film, which we talk a lot about here. Or music certainly has felt the blow from that, and print media. So yeah, that discussion is obviously really relevant. And I think I agree with you on most points. I think that this movie kind of creeps on its thesis. It takes a while to get there, and you're kind of wondering, okay, is this just about how big of a fan you are? Because I'm not that interested.
Yeah. And he wasn't charismatic enough.
No.
Or German enough, because
if it was Werner Herzog's, then
yeah. Well, I mean, Werner Herzog does that sometimes too, and I'm kind of like, okay, get to the point, Werner. but you kind of along for the ride because he has that voice, I guess. I don't know why I do more with him than this guy. But
well, yeah, there's an aspect of this documentary that's kind of selfie. And he's struggling to telling his story, which is how he grew up with the comic and what it means to him, versus the real thesis of Bill Waterston and his work methods and how that has only aided in his legacy, which is the much more interesting story to tell. Somebody should have seen that in this assembly and said, you have half a documentary here, go make the other half.
Mm-hmm. Well, going to the Werner Herzog thing, this was definitely influenced by, I think the kid at least watched a couple of his films before he did this, and it's trying to kind of go into that kind of documentarian kind of style.
Yeah.
I don't think it necessarily achieves that, but again, I do think that the later half of the film does
work. It gets interesting. It accumulates after a while. It just takes a while to get there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that there are three kind of acts, I guess, to this documentary. Mm-hmm. And it's the first act that doesn't. And so whenever a first act doesn't work very well, it kind of makes you drag along, mm-hmm. or makes it feel like it drags along. When in reality, the film, probably the last two thirds of the film, the last two acts, I do think are very interesting and very poignant and, mm-hmm. and fairly, and pretty well done.
And a lot of his interviews, his interview subjects, so a lot of these other illustrators, you know, obviously, I'm sure he would have loved to get Bill Waterston on camera, but that just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
So instead, you're hearing it all through the perspective of these other people, as if he's a, you know, person who died. And that's really interesting, because that really speaks to who Bill Waterston is anyway. And, you know, a lot of these interviews are really candid. Well, they'll say things like, oh, yeah, he, you know, we wrote letters to each other and he would draw these comics about how he thinks I'm a corporate sellout.
Yeah.
And then they'd show those. And that's the interesting stuff. That's the stuff you want to see.
Yeah. And I believe that was the cat guy. Anyway. No, yeah. I did think that was interesting. And you know what? He wrote this really, it's actually a comic about, like, it's more of an autobiographical comic, and it's maybe, it's two panels by two panels, and it's probably, I don't know, 16 panels in total, somewhere mm-hmm. around there. And I mean, it kind of puts out Bill Waterston's, thesis too, which is, you know, it's not just, you know, life isn't just about making money. You know, if I wanted to make cartoons, yeah. If I wanted to make money, I wouldn't have been making cartoons. That's not the point of them. And you know what? I think it's actually kind of, I think what another thing that kind of works about the documentary, which I think can be applied at a larger scale, is the issue, you know. Do we need to make a profit and make money and make a product? Yeah, we do. But do we need to make a product that makes all the money and dominates and takes over the world and invades religion and society and your life and everything? No, we don't. That's not the point of a lot of these products and a lot of the things that you're selling.
And one of the things that Bill Waterston has going for him, and what makes Calvin the Hobbes so well respected, isn't just that it's not being shoved down your throat 24/7 on t-shirts and lunch pails, but also, you know, he got out while the getting was good. He left on a high note.
Right.
He didn't stay in the game forever and just dragged on a project that he wasn't interested in doing anymore. It had its run. It was a good run. And he left. And it's kind of this clean, pure object that exists,
right?
And he wants to maintain that it stays that way.
And I think that that's, and yeah, I mean,
there's so much about his operation that is just antithetical to everything in pop culture.
Mm-hmm. But I maybe that's a lesson that needs to be learned, especially now.
Yeah.
Where everything, you know, you as just a person on Facebook are supposed to have a brand.
Oh, yeah. You're supposed to chill yourself 24/7. I mean, if you want to, you know, do anything, if you're doing anything even the least bit entrepreneurial.
If you want to be a plumber.
Yeah.
If you want to be anything, you have to brand yourself in some way in this day and age. And the fact that he did it without, I mean, he is a little bit beforehand. There was something kind of sad in this film about the fact that kids will never experience those Sunday strips the way we did. We were like one of the last generations to get that.
Oh, yeah. They were. I remember specifically, if we want to go into my selfie moment.
Yeah.
I remember specifically my parents would read me the strips, and I would we'd always start with Calvin and Hobbes because that was my favorite one.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was kind of everything else after that.
Yeah.
And yeah, like I just that was, and I don't even know if I was consciously remember it ending or if I just thought, oh, I kind of grew out of it or whatever. But yeah, no, it was a special treat. But, you know, those, it still exists in the books,
mm-hmm.
and there's those really gorgeous complete editions that are in the hardback.
Yeah, they are. They're really nice.
And it exists, like I said, as kind of a solitary object now, and people, and I've reread a lot of Calvin and Hobbes recently, because we had a roommate that had a bunch of that, and I took it to work and read it on my off hours, and it holds up no matter what age you are. Like, it is actually funnier when you're older.
Yeah, no, I mean, and it does, it's something that you don't realize,
mm-hmm.
and I think that, you know, that's something that is good about being a quote-unquote low art, is you can be very subversive.
Yeah.
Because people aren't going to take you serious, and so you can do something that is as, you know...
thoughtful, or...
You can do something thoughtful, or interesting, or whatever, in the form of comics. And it doesn't, you know, and so I also like the film that it was kind of, even though the filmmaker said he's not a pro comic person, I think that there's something about this that says that, you know, there is a pro comic message in this.
There's definitely, it's an insider look at the medium itself and even more kind of nichier aspect of it, because we're not talking about DC, Marvel, comic books, you know, superhero stuff. We're talking about Sunday paper illustrators.
Well, we're also...
And that's...
I think it goes into that world, too, because it's not an easy thing to do. You know, people take it as disposable, but you're coming up with a punchline every week.
Yeah, it's almost
every
like...
Every day, every...
It's almost like having to be able to be, like, creative writing haikus. You know, it's such a limited form. It's so small... And you have so it's getting smaller every year, that you really have to think really how to strip away everything and minimalistically come up with these things.
You have to be very economical in your approach to it, and you have to
you don't have a full 20 pages, or you don't have a full page sometimes.
Yeah, and so what's beautiful about something like Calvin and Hobbes is he is that economic, and he is that, you know, he delivers.
Yeah, and it never felt like he was phoning it in. Like, you know, you read Garfield nowadays, and most of the time it's like, okay, whatever.
He ate lasagna. Cool.
Yeah.
Cool story, bro.
Look, a spider.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's... No, and the same thing, you know, and they do bring up the fact that, you know, I think the Peanuts, you know, when I think about them, I think about the cartoons.
Yeah.
You know, like Charlie Brown Christmas, that kind of thing.
And most of them are really good. Yeah.
Yeah, and... But the fact that, when it does come up in MetLife or anything of those iterations, you know, younger generations, that's what they think of the Peanuts. They have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, they see it more as a, like, it's like Hello Kitty, where all these Americans, they didn't even know there was a cartoon. They just think of it as this thing that's on purses and cell phones, like cell phone cases. So it's good to have that kind of, you know, if you have to come to the work, the work's not going to come to you.
Well, I think, and one of the things that he did do, you know, is he did bring, you know, those Scholastic, though, you know, he broke into that market at the right time. So, I mean, it kind of was a perfect storm, and it just worked. It was lightning in a bottle.
And as a documentary, going back to the movie.
Yeah.
I think it's all right. Unfortunately, I don't think it's that great. It's kind of mediocre, but I think that there's interesting stuff in here. And if you're a fan of the comic, especially, you'll be able to wade through the less interesting parts to get to the good stuff.
Yeah, and I think you just have to get through that first third, and then I think you're okay. I actually think that the next half, I think that the last two thirds, I mean, are pretty good. I don't think that they're, again, maybe, you know, I wouldn't say top level documentary. I would say, you know, a pretty good look at something that you could, if you're interested in it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right. I don't think it's a transcending, it's no Earl Morris. No.
No. Well, I mean, it's more or less, it's like a thesis paper put on film.
Yeah, agreed.
So there may or may not be an episode next week. We're both kind of indisposed, and I might be able to scrounge something together. But the next episode I will be doing with you, I'm going to have you watch Alice.
Okay.
Which is a bizarre, surrealist, stop-motion animated film about a take on Alice in Wonderland from 1988. And that ought to be fun to talk about.
Well, you sold me. I'm ready.
Until then, if anybody has any comments they want to send our way, either on, you know, our opinions or this show, or if you have pet topic ideas, that would be wonderful. We're always looking for those. Or you just want to weigh in on any of the movies we talked about, The Purge, Anarchy, Dear Mr. Watterson, or Alice, whenever we decide to do that. You can do so at our email, which is jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. You can also follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/jabberpodcast and see other news stories that we don't talk about or any updates on the show itself. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio or Pocket Cast and listen to us on your favorite mobile device. And while you're at iTunes or Stitcher, please leave us a star rating and a one-sentence review. And you can also find our regular RSS feed and archives at jabberinthedrone.podbean.com. You can read the movie reviews that I do for the Idaho State Journal weekly at southforkreviews.blogspot.com. You can read the reviews and articles I write for the Seattle-based website MacGuffin at mcguff.in/author/Cassidy. I have a review in the can. It's about ready to come through their pipeline at some point. And you can read Richard's stuff that he does every week at his blog, rdwally.weebly.com.
Whoa, you're promising a lot.
Every week, Richard.
You know, get on it. I should. You're right, I should be doing that. I'm not, but... I'm just not a very good blogger. I don't like to blog.
See, you're not millennial enough. You're not millennial enough. You have to want to talk about yourself constantly.
I know. I need to take selfies and stuff.
Yeah, just do it. And check out Brad and Amanda's podcast. They've kind of been pod fading a little bit because one of the key members of their podcast, Quarter Life Crisis, has been away, but he's back, so they'll probably be doing an episode soon at quartercrisis.podbean.com. And there's a great podcast I kind of just discovered, and I just kind of want to promote them because I think they're great, and they only have 3 out so far, and they're still kind of new, called Unseen Footage, and they have a blog spot, I believe. I think if you type in Unseen Footage podcast, it should pop up in your Google.
What do these people do? What are they about?
They review movies. They talk about movies that one of them has seen when he was a kid and is kind of nostalgia for. Like they just recently did an episode for Clueless, which, you know, I love Clueless. And they also did one for the 1989 Batman and Hook. And his co-host has not seen the movie. And she has to... First she describes what she thinks it's going to be. Then they start recording and they kind of discuss it in about... You know, does it live up to the cultural hype?
Hmm.
It's an interesting podcast, and there's not a lot of movie review podcasts that learn how to do this and from a new angle, and they somehow managed to figure it out. So check them out, Unseen Footage. And until then, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, have a good one. Bye.
Bye.